Do you find that being the first immigrant, the first Latino, first openly gay, youngest, and so on, does that tend to overshadow or distract from your work itself, or is it, you know, is it kind of part of the work?
Sure. And also the first engineer, though that wasn't very sexy enough for the media, I guess. But anyway, yeah, the list of firsts could go on and on. But I really don't understand, and maybe I'm just always get this question wrong or get the answer wrong, but I just don't understand how some people would be bothered by just being who they are. I mean, if we look deep into our lives, we're the first of many things, yeah. Right? These are things these are my stories, and I don't want anyone to take them away from me. And it's been what I've been writing about since I started writing, so why would I deny them now? Now, I can understand if you have a label that's a sort of a false label or a label that you're not really into or something like that, but I have embraced them. I embrace them all because it's part of who I am, part of my work.
You mentioned engineer. Are there other labels that get left off the list that are important to who you are?
Engineering is one big one, and actually I have read at a few engineering firms, which is always a great thrill for me because I speak their language, so to speak.
Right.
No, I think that covers a lot of ground.
It's a lot.
If you include engineer, I think that pretty much covers almost every dimension of my life.
Maybe I would venture to suggest that diplomat could fit in there somewhere. I think we most recently saw you in Havana speaking at the ceremonies there as the U.S.'s relationship with Cuba changes. And as a Cuban-American, I'm really anxious to hear, you know, your thoughts on that changing relationship.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that is something that now there's a label I sort of am still growing into or a dimension of my life that's so brand new. Besides the inauguration, I've done several poems occasional poems one could say, or commissioned pieces one could say, one of them being a poem called Until We Could, which was for the Freedom to Marry organization and to celebrate their 10th year anniversary, and that was made into a film, a short video. There's been Boston Strong, which was another sort of very public poem that was read at the benefit concert. Writing the poem for the embassy was almost like the inauguration, that kind of event where there's the interface of poetry and politics. It was just an amazing experience, that one in particular, because it's so close to home. While the inauguration, of course, was on a grand, grand scale, this was much closer to home. This was almost personal. This mm-hmm. is something that I've been writing about in a way since I first wrote a poem. The poem itself, and I think my reading a poem sort of did ruffle some feathers. I think made some people think, made some people angry. But again, I just love that poetry was even included in that. You know, the way that poems can speak to us publicly in ways that politics can't. In a way, I think about it also as cultural. The idea of in Latin American cultures, how prevalent poetry is, and how poets, for example, in Cuba, are revolutionary figures like José Martí. So, I mean, I'm not putting myself up there. It gives me a sort of a little bit of a template, a little bit of a blueprint on. A little bit of a precedent.
Did you find that in Cuba people were familiar with your work and interested specifically in hearing from you?
No. My time during the embassy was really short. I was basically only had one full day there. So it was one day and two half days. I did go in June just before, and certainly some of the poets and some of the arts crowd did recognize me. But remember, we're talking about a country where access to television and whatnot is not easy. And it's also not the United States. I mean, let's put it plainly that way. The rest of the world isn't sitting around watching the inauguration like we are. I mean, we barely do, right? So it wasn't that level of exposure, but certainly the artists and whatnot. What was beautiful was after the embassy, that was broadcast live. And, of course, that was much more on the radar of the people of Cuba, right. Something that I think, for the most part, most were embracing and very hopeful, cautiously hopeful about the changes on the horizon. So after the ceremony, people were recognizing me in the street and taking pictures and whatnot, and really sort of really, really welcoming and warm, because in a way I'm a son of, half of me is a son of that island, you know. So I think they felt close. Well, I felt close to them as well. It was really nice to be able to actually have those kinds of literal embraces on the streets of Havana.
One thing that's happening right now in Pennsylvania is there's legislation that's been introduced in the state legislature, not for the first time, proposing that English should be the official language of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And given certainly your where you figure in this conversation about national identity and especially how language is part of that, I wonder if I could get your thoughts on this sort of perennial attempt to legislate English as an official language. And also, you know, how do you address the relationship between language and national identity in your work?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm not familiar with what's going on exactly there in Pennsylvania, but I would have to ask what the intent is. I think in some cases, by doing that, you actually get funds for teaching ESL. So I'm not sure. I have a sense and a perception. I mean, I was educated in English, and I learned Spanish at home. And on the one hand, I think it's just sort of, I think it sort of sends the wrong message to say something like that, because it's sort of saying, well, your language doesn't count, and your language is, and your culture, by saying your language, you're also saying your culture doesn't count. I also know that if you don't learn English in the United States, you do have sort of a ceiling, and I see that with my cousins in Miami and things like that. So, but certainly, besides all that, I just think, you know, having two languages and the reflections of two languages is just, you know, only an asset, an incredible asset. They've done studies where bilingual people are actually better problem solvers. There's been all sorts of things to support that being able to have the dimension of another language and access to another way of thinking and another culture in the end is much more valuable. So I don't like the message that legislation sets in that sense. I mean, if we really look at the narrative of the United States, it is all about the embracing of other cultures, and somehow we keep on having reactionary issues against that. And from the very pilgrims that were exiles themselves to, you know, all the great groups of immigrants that have made this country what it is, and you know, that was one of the reasons I felt so touched and so honored to serve as presidential inaugural poet was to recognize that narrative of immigrant, of Latino, among other groups, that is part of the American narrative.
All right. Well, Mr. Blanco, thank you so much for talking with me. I'm really looking forward to your visit.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to connecting with Pittsburgh. Two of my books of poetry have been published there, and I've been always wanting to see where my little babies are born.
Right. Well, safe travels. We look forward to seeing you here.